individuals. It simply doesn't work anymore. Brands, sure, a useful heuristic, but ultimately everything is all systems, interlaced. A single product manufactured by a single company for a single global market. Spicy, medium, or chunky. They get a choice, of course, of course! But they are buying salsa.
My God, the Golden Buster!
Hello and welcome to Star Wars Spoilers. You've stumbled upon an 8-episode miniseries dedicated to the Starz TV show, American Gods. I'm Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Gail Folsom.
Each week, we, two book readers and amateur Neil Gaiman experts, will unpack the latest episode of American Gods. Despite the name of this podcast, we will not be spoiling anything in this episode beyond Season 1, Episode 5, Lemon-Scented You, directed by Vincenzo Natali, and written by Brian Fuller, Michael Green, and David Graziano. But before we dive into Episode 5, we wanted to check in on a listener email. Gail?
Our listener email comes from Sean, who says, "Hi guys, love the podcast, really enjoying your insights so far. Just thought I would add a little inside info about the card shuffler. Like you, I was expecting it to be a bigger deal in the episode, as I know the show went to the effort to source multiple shufflers from the manufacturer, including having the manufacturer review the episode's script under an NDA to ensure the episode did not imply that the shufflers could be misused to alter the outcome of the game. Seems like a lot of effort for one basically throwaway scene. So I imagine that originally this was going to be a larger part of the story."
So this is all speculation on Sean's part, who like asked us to omit some information because Sean knows someone who signed the NDA. You know, we're not trying to get anyone, Sean's friend, family, or otherwise in trouble. But that is interesting information. I don't know the rules of like what you get a sort of card shuffler expert to weigh in on or not, but one guess could be, you know, since this refers to episode 4, the Laura episode, that maybe they showed some of the heist that Laura was planning for Shadow to do, whatever the scam was, her perfect plan. I kind of like it in the episode that she's like, "The plan's perfect. You can't get caught." And then it cut, like, smash cut to, "How did you get caught?" You know what I mean? Like, they skip right past even what the plan is. And that's kind of fun. But it's possible that there was a different version of the episode where the plan was actually either explained or, you know, shittily executed. And, you know, it's possible that the card shuffler could have been involved in that. We don't know.
I don't know. It did seem like, I think I mentioned it at that first episode or the Laura episode, that it seemed kind of, you know, odd that this was made much of. This was something that was taken away from her. But yeah, in the final analysis, it did seem like it was just, oh, well, this is another thing that Laura doesn't get to do anymore, as opposed to like some significance to the mechanized card shuffler.
Right. That's true. And then before we get into the episode itself, I wanted to issue a correction. I had a couple people point out, I last week said that during the sort of Laura Weary Married Life montage, that the song Stupid Girl by Garbage played over the episode. And that was true for the version that I watched and Gail watched, because we had a screener from the network that, you know, that went out in advance. But in the episode that aired on Starz that all of you watched, it was actually a different song called Queen of the Board that Shirley Manson of Garbage fame wrote with Brian Reitzel, I think. And so, yeah, so it's its own song that they wrote for American Gods. It was not Stupid Girl. Stupid Girl apparently was a temp track, though it works really well in that scene, I'll tell you that. But they traded that Shirley Manson song in the screener for a different one when you guys watched it. So you're not crazy. We're not crazy. We just watched two slightly different
shows. No one's wrong. We have our own truths.
But going forward, in the back four of the season, including this episode, we should all be watching the same thing. Because the first four screeners went out a long time ago, and these four are sort of coming out contemporaneously with what you'll be seeing on Stars, so we should all be on the same page going forward. But, you know, if you have any other feedback, question, comments, or concerns, you can email us at stormofspoilers@gmail.com, or you can send us a tweet at Joe Wrote This or at Clockwork Rose on Twitter. Let us get right into this episode, episode 5. We are over halfway into the season. Lemon Scented You.
And great title.
We open with something kind of unusual. It's a Coming to America vignette, like we've seen in almost every episode so far. But this one is animated versus the rest of them. And this sort of tells the story of the Inuits coming to America. This sort of, I think it's a mammoth god, Nunninini. I just basically garbled that. I don't want to say it again. And this is like medicine woman at Sula. And sacrifice and, you know, just the harrowing experience of coming across the Bering Strait, I guess, to America. What did you think of this sequence, Gail, and also the decision to animate it versus do live action?
I have to be honest, this is my least favorite part of the episode. I didn't really like the animation. I didn't think that it wasn't sufficiently, I guess, different. It did not depart sufficiently from the Uncanny Valley to make me feel very attached to or to make me relate very well to the characters. I understood the sacrifice that Sula made. Like, that made sense to me. I did not understand what happened to her husband character, the male character. Yeah, this, like, I liked the final piece of narration from Mr. Ibis about human hearts and humans being greater than gods, because humans return to humans eventually, and gods can die and are forgotten. And I thought that was a great truth that was illustrated by this Coming to America story. I was not crazy about it. Sorry to just like start off on a downer, but I was not moved by this particular vignette.
Yeah, I also wasn't very fond of it. And I think there's something about the animation style where, like, because American Gods is such a stylized show to begin with, right at the beginning, you don't even necessarily know that it is animated. So I actually think that they could have gone less photorealistic with the animation and done something more like, I don't know, Secret of Kells. I mean, obviously not that style, but something different,
referencing, you know? Maybe the one thing about Secret of Kells that's successful is that it references illustration themes from illuminated manuscripts. So there's a clear point of reference to something that was a style of the time. So if you wanted to do a similar, like, you know, period referential animation, you could use, you know, petroglyphs and cave paintings and hieroglyphs of the time period and maybe get your point across a little bit better.
Yeah, I always think the gold standard for this type of thing is the, I don't know how many times you've seen, I actually don't know how much of a Harry Potter fan you are, but
I've seen all the Harry Potters numerous times. How about that?
Okay. The story of the three brothers that happens in the Deathly Hallows film is like just some of the most beautiful animation, I think.
Yeah, and that was really well done.
Yeah, and just like a really good example of shifting from live action to animation and back again.
Yes.
And while making me feel like this is definitely worth it and worked really well. So, yeah.
I think the other thing that put that opening sequence at a disadvantage was the new credit sequence, which was
it's not new. Like, this is once again our screener privilege.
Oh dear,
our screener privilege showing itself. We did not have that opening credits on our screeners, but the rest of the world's been dealing with it from the beginning. So,
oh, that's too bad. I would have talked about that a lot earlier. But I think I will say, like, in juxtaposition, yeah, like the opening credit sequence, I'm sad we never talked about that because I was like, holy crap, yeah. This is great. Robot dog Sphinx and the TriStar Pegasus. Astronaut Jesus?
Yes, Astronaut Jesus.
Menorah Mikes? yeah, so I, for me, having seen that credit sequence for the first time and then seeing this, like, I won't say subpar, but like it was, I think it was trying, the Uncanny Valley.
I think it was trying for that, for a Deathly Hallows thing and just sort of missed the mark. Or yeah, I just trying to be, I don't know. If you're going to try to.
It ended up looking like, you know, like the style of the figures was that sort of like current Pixar animation style where everyone has like long, it was like, you know, Despicable Me where they had like really long spindly limbs. And it was just, it was far enough removed from being people that it didn't really, they didn't really look like real people. But at the same time, there was so much texturing laid over the figures that I was like, I can't tell if we're supposed to be projecting onto these figures or taking them as individuals. My lizard brain was confused about that.
All right. So, I mean, let's roll from this opening, which neither of us really liked, to something that I at least did like, which is, yes, some Laura Shadow stuff. We see, I feel like I've been building up to this moment for so long because I feel like Shadow walking into the room ended, I want to say, episode 3, and then like, yeah, Laura getting to the room ended episode 4. So we finally see like what comes next is, yes, episode 5. And we see Laura greeting Shadow. She says she's cold, which, you know, she is all the time. He throws a pillow at her, which is a nice little bit of comedy. He calls her out on her cheating pretty immediately, which is pretty great. She explains to him what happened, which felt maybe a little unnecessary since we just watched what happened. You know, she didn't like really add much to what we learned in episode 4, so her,
yeah,
explaining
it pretty short.
She asks him for cigarettes. She looks at him very lovingly as his, like, he takes his little glowing sun self out of the room. And we see some ravens spying on them. And then I would just say that Shadow takes a long time getting those Virginia Slims out of the vending machine. He's got a lot to think about, and the show executes one of its like many moody, I'm going to show this Virginia Slims package flying through black outer space for a little while shots.
Yeah.
Someone is watching Shadow from their car, and then Laura is in the tub trying to warm her body up. So, how did you feel about this sort of fateful meeting between Laura and Shadow?
The whole Laura and Shadow meeting again sequence further endeared this version of Laura to me, in the way that the show has decided to treat her. And it's partly because, like, in the last episode we talked about like the honesty of the conversation between Laura and Shadow, and that was here again. I really like the way that she has been scripted, and I really like the way that Emily Browning delivers her lines. There's something about Laura, the way that she talks, where she, you know, she, there's a sort of like vulgarity about her coming out of like Emily Browning's petite, beautiful little face. She says, you know what they say, next to every cemetery is a motel. Mm-hmm. She talks about like her like goodbye blowjob to Robbie. She says, you know, one more time with feeling. Like all these like sort of vulgar colloquialisms. But, you know, for every question that Shadow poses to her, she gives him a really honest answer.
Yeah.
And she tells him the absolute truth. And yeah, it's interesting because like there's a sense in this version that's not, that I would say is not in the books, that in the book singular, but there's a sense that And Shadow kind of admits to it too, that Laura has always been very much in charge in this relationship. In her sort of, you know, ennui-filled way, she has been guiding this whole relationship. Shadow will do whatever Laura says all the time. And this is now, there's an extra level of honesty on their relationship, because it's becoming like, it's not that way anymore. Shadow, like, Laura's embarrassed about what she did and she feels at a disadvantage, but she's still talking to him as though he's going to do whatever she tells him to do. Would you get me a cigarette, puppy? It might calm my nerves. Might calm your nerves too. Like, I'm going to have a cigarette. Can you go get it for me? Also, why don't you have one? You know, like, just sort of this, this order giving. And then there's an expectation, maybe a little, you know, a little hesitant on her side, that this is just going to be fine. And now they're together and that's going to be fine. It's fine that she's dead. I mean, obviously we have some things to work on in our relationship. Like, this is okay. I know you want me back. And in the end, it doesn't seem like Shadow is just going to jump right back into this and, you know, come up to her tail wagging and be her puppy again. He also says, I don't know, like, she's like, do you want to talk about like the miracle that I'm sitting in front of you postmortem? And he's like, no, you can't distract me with the fact that you rose from the grave. We're going to talk about your infidelity. That's what's really important to me. Like, what's important to Shadow is Shadow's feelings. And it's like, that's never been taken into consideration in this relationship before.
Yeah, that's a good point. Before we get to sort of, I have some questions about how Laura feels about Shadow right now. But before we get to that, I just need to take a quick detour to what I suspect might be, Gil, your fate. Well, I'm not going to presume, but we get a scene in the hallway where Wednesday talks to a raven. They're ravens? Crows? Ravens?
It was a raven. It was a raven.
He talks to Raven and he goes, what? To a raven, and just the shot, like the sight of Ian McShane just like addressed, like just taking this raven, talking to him perfectly seriously, yeah, and just like frustrated and hassled and just like all this sort of stuff.
Ugh, calm down.
What? really cracked me up. So I thought of you immediately. I was like, I can't wait for Gail to see the scene where he talks to a raven. Okay. Gail has a thing with ravens. So
I have a thing about ravens. And I also have to say, like, I'm just going to interject right here and say, ravens are really, really big birds. And like, you don't really, if you haven't been close to a raven in person, they're very imposing. There's a reason that the Norse chose ravens to be Odin's companions. They are really large, imposing birds. And they have, you know, crows and ravens traditionally in like Western culture have sort of like, you know, a gallows and battlefield kind of connotation. They're not to be trifled with. So I always think ravens are especially hilarious when they're talking to Ian McShane. You're right. That's my favorite part.
So then we cut back to the hotel room. Shadow has returned the cigarette. Laura cannot taste the cigarette. Shadow gives her ring back. He tells her that he has sort of had this premonition that she might die, which sort of speaks to Shadow's prophetic self. And then Laura stands up so we can see the extent of the scarring on her body. She goes over and she kisses Shadow and her heart jolts awake. And she says, I tasted that. And she says, are you still my puppy? And he says, no, I'm not. And so a couple things. Like, I'm curious if you think, like, how much are we meant, you know, there were all these questions in the last episode and throughout the season of, like, how much did Laura actually ever love Shadow? Mm-hmm. And then how much does she love him now because she loves him, or she loves him now because he's like the only source of heat on this planet for her? Like she almost has like a vampiric relationship.
Yeah, or she's like under some kind of spell.
And he's beholden
to him somehow.
Yeah, and he's the only, like, kissing him is the only thing that made her heart actually beat. So like, why wouldn't she want to be around him kissing him more if she can feel alive doing that. And then this question of like, are you still my puppy? No, I'm not, made me think of that interview that I did with Neil Gaiman last week, where he said it was really important to consider the shadow that comes out of jail, the shadow post Laura's death, as a different guy than the one we met before. So I don't, I didn't take his "no, I'm not" as she did, which is, or as she seemed to, which is like as a rejection of her. I took it more as like him defining himself, like, are you still my puppy? And him being like, no, I'm not that guy. That doesn't mean no, I don't ever want to be with you, but like, I'm not going to be in that puppy role.
Not your pet. I don't know. I like, there are a number of different ways that you could take that, but I was similarly struck by, you know, Laura was being so vulnerable, which is sort of unusual for her, I think, based on what we saw in the last episode. And her vulnerability led her to assume that what he was, and they got interrupted in a way, but her vulnerability led her to assume that he was referring to her, like, no, I'm not your puppy. I'll go be someone else's puppy. But I think, you know, the question could be, like, his answer could be interpreted as he's not the same man who was her puppy. Or if he's not Laura's, is it because she's dead and he's not, he hasn't forgotten that yet and it can't be the same? So no, I'm not, you're dead. I can't be your puppy anymore. Something has to change.
Right.
I'm not, can't be like it was.
Yeah. I'm going to stick with, I'm not that guy until I feel like I'm proven otherwise. that's my story. I'm sticking to it. But you're right. They do get interrupted because Wednesday knocks on the door. Shadow tries to fend him off, but Shadow's a really bad liar and no match for Wednesday at all. Wednesday says it smells of cat piss and oven cleaner, which is just a nice evocative sort of like, Laura may look kind of pretty despite all her scars, but that's a nice little olfactory descriptor. And then the cops come for Shadow on Wednesday, thanks to the bank robbery. And Laura, like, she sees his glowing, sunshiny light go away, but she doesn't know why he's gone, because her head was under the water while the cops rolled up conveniently. So that is the close of that Shadow Laura reunion. It's clear that Wednesday does not want Shadow around Laura. That's what's clear to me in the scene anyway, is like the Raven's a little tattletale, is like, Shadow's with his dark wife, you know, and then, you know, you didn't know I had a Raven impression, but apparently. And then Mr. Wendy's like, that will not do, because that is a distraction.
I got rid of her for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. So
come have a drink. Five, six.
Yeah, let's go. Whatever it is, we gotta get out of here. So then the cops come, you know, and then the question we can ask ourselves is like, did Shadow arrange for those cops to come? But that's a larger question for later in the episode. But next, we return to the technology boy who we've not seen since episode one. He's leaving a rave, and he gets kidnapped the same way that he kidnapped... Sorry, the technical boy, not the technology boy. The technical boy. He gets abducted the same way that Shadow did, that he did to Shadow. And instead of him in what looks like sort of a limousine-esque thing, we get media waiting, dressed as... okay, so here's the thing. Stars, the network, when they first sent out the photo, this photo, they sent it out with a disclaimer of like nowhere in the email where they sent out this photo did they use the words either David or Bowie. In the email, they just said, you know, media can appear as a number of figures, you know, like blah, blah, blah. So like, basically it seems like Starz does not have the license to clear calling this a David Bowie impression. And, there's two things we can say about this.
You Interesting. Know,
Gillian Anderson's definitely dressed as David Bowie, but we could pretend that she's not, but except she's spouting David Bowie lyrics. But also in the background is this like fake David Bowie song that they've clearly composed. Like, I feel like if they had gotten the rights to David Bowie's likeness, they might have also gotten the rights to a song, and it would have been like a Let's Dance or something, like some actual Bowie song behind her, as opposed to this fake Bowie song. But anyway, we have media waiting, dressed as a redheaded British pop figure, and She's chastising the technical boy, saying he needs to apologize to Shadow, and that a mysterious Mr. World we've not met yet is quite upset. She drops lyrics like "beating up the wrong guy," which is from Life on Mars. There's a terror in knowing what Mr. World is about. She accuses the technical boy of putting out fire with gasoline. And then she says, "Now there are starmen waiting in the sky," which alluringly Brian Fuller has said we will meet the starmen waiting in the sky in season 2. I'm like, are there aliens in season 2?
I know.
Or angels? Or what's happening? Anyway, Gil, what our listeners may not know is that maybe second only to your love of ravens in Norse mythology is your love of David Bowie. So what did you make of this scene?
I have to tell you that, like, I did not orchestrate this in any way, but I walked into the living room in my home today, and my children were watching Labyrinth. And, like, I sat down and watched Labyrinth with them. I am still upset over our loss of David Bowie. But I was really excited to see Gillian Anderson's David Bowie impression, and having just watched David Bowie in a performance, maybe not the one of his lifetime, but I've also seen David Bowie in concert. I've seen him in a lot of different permutations, and I thought she did a really good job. I think, you know, she's sort of somewhere in between, you know, Ziggy and Aladdin Sane in that outfit. And the background music was a very obvious sort of David Bowie reference, but it's pretty catchy.
My roommate, I say that too. That's weird because you know my roommate, but the listeners, my roommate and I were like kind of like singing it after it was over. We were like, oh, because it plays in the closing credits too. So
it does. I know. I stayed to listen to the end credits so I could hear it some more. It was pretty good.
I agree. I feel like there were some parts where she completely nailed the impression. Like a few sentences where I was just
Her makeup and okay, I'm sorry, but like her contact lenses, they put a contact lenses in at least one of her eyeballs because David Bowie, when he was very young, not only did he have the I can't remember the name for this condition where one of your eyes is blue and one is green or one is brown and one is blue, but he also got into some kind of fight or accident when he was younger, and so one of his pupils was sort of permanently dilated, and they put like some kind of contact or eye drops in her eye to dilate one of her pupils to reference that extremely closely. The costuming was amazing, and
it's called heterochromia.
Thank you, heterochromia. So double whammy there. It was an interesting choice too. It's sort of weird timing just because, you know, David Bowie so recently died. They are having media and be, you know, she's impersonating, embodying these extremely influential people. And, you know, there's another one coming up in the same episode, who have changed the face of entertainment. And in doing so have influenced culture. And one of the reasons that I've always really loved David Bowie is because of the, in my opinion, the way that he was openly odd and strange and weird and challenging and just sort of encouraged in doing so, encouraged other people to express themselves. He was an icon of self-expression. So it's sort of weird to me actually to see a David Bowie impression by a character who is so sinister in a lot of ways. It's sort of like a perversion of art almost.
from a script writing perspective, some of the lyrics kind of worked well and were kind of cute, and some just felt really forced. Like, there's the terror in knowing what Mr. World is about. I feel like I could hear the writers thinking themselves very clever with that, and I just didn't really land for me. But some of the, you know, beating up the wrong guy was kind of cute, or, you know, putting out fire with gasoline is kind of cute. But anyway, so that's the technical boy. That's some new god interaction for us right there. In the books, you know, Mr. World, who we're about to meet, has some henchmen. There's Mr. Wood, Mr. Stone, Mr. Town, Mr. Road. We might still meet them, but my guess is that instead we will just have sort of Media and the technical boy acting as sort of henchmen-esque figures. Mm. It's possible. I mean, they can't quite do everything that Stone and Wood and Town and Road did, but my guess is that they won't give us these anonymous henchmen, and instead we will get more Jim Anderson, because why wouldn't you want that, right? So
yeah, I that's the impression that I got from that notable admission,
right? But so Bowie is not in the books, obviously, and we then cut to Shadow and Wednesday getting interrogated, and Wednesday doing a hilarious, confused old man act that he drops actually pretty quickly, which is a bummer because I kind of wanted him to keep it up.
Yeah.
he quotes a little bit of poetry, Henley's poem that goes, "Madam, life's a peace in bloom. Death goes dogging everywhere. She's the tenant of the room. He's the ruffian on the stair." It just felt like some old, like senile nonsense. But I don't know if anyone else had some ideas as why that little snatch of poetry made it into his act. The cop interrogating Shadow says they were tipped off via a fax machine that hasn't worked in forever. And that's what's going on at the jail. What did you think of all this interrogation stuff?
A sense of foreboding for Lady Cop, because she obviously was too good at her job. And she, you know, Laura says earlier in the episode, "You got yourself mixed up in some really weird shit, puppy." And Lady Cop, that line, she says something like, "I'm a big girl, I make my own mistakes." And I was like, yeah, I can see where this is going. This is a really big mistake. The omission of having read the book, the omission of Mr. Wood and Mr. Stone. Thank you, Mr. Wood and Mr. Stone. I was like, what's the other element? I thought that was interesting, and it made me sort of wonder what the show writers felt either about those characters. Maybe those characters were just not, big enough characters compared to Media and the technical boy. Or again, is there something that is significantly changed in our culture so that those characters are not as relevant? Because those characters were sort of like the, homicide detective gods, the CIA spook gods. CIA spook, well, except, spook, yeah, yeah, they, I mean, they make a joke about the CIA actually in the book, but, they were trope gods kind of, and maybe they were just not they were such demigods, of the early aughts that they didn't make it into our current iteration.
Yeah. I almost wonder if Mr. Smith in The Matrix has ruined,
basically, the CIA spook misters.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't think you can do Mr. Town and Mr. Road or Mr. Stone, Mr. Mm-hmm. Wood without really evoking Mr. Smith from The Matrix. I don't know. I don't know if that's
Well, the other thing, maybe this is, this is getting into our next big bad, but, in terms of art imitating life, maybe the personification of Mr. World has become such a reality in our modern in our modern life that we don't need Mr. Town. I mean, does that make sense? Am I being really weird right now? Like, Mr. World is sort of a surveillance god. He's an all, quote unquote, all-knowing. You know, he compiles a great deal of data on the individual. And if you if you truly have a character who is able to do that, or you know, a deity, a being, then do you need the townies?
What is the management for?
Yeah. Well, why do you need the small town guys? You know, like, maybe it was just that at the time it was difficult for Gaiman to envision the extent to which we would be more and more aware of each other and have access to information to the point where, like, you know, Mr. Road is irrelevant. Mr. Town is irrelevant. Mr. Town is disappearing, in fact. He was at the time of writing, and is he gone now? I don't know.
No, I like that, you know, sort of I would actually put that at the feet of the technical boy, like, this idea of community, of town, of road, of infrastructure, is sort of going away for, you know, to be replaced with the online town and road. So, that is interesting. I actually don't know that I have, like, a really strong grip on what Mr. Wood, Mr. Stone, Mr. Town, Mr. Road are meant to represent.
Yeah,
they're not, like, you know, God analogs, really. And I understand that, like, you know, Wood and Stone and Town and Road make up Mr. World, like, you know, like, but
not in the way that Mr. World current, like, in this realization, not in the way that Mr. World functions.
All right. Let's get to Mr. World, but first let us dip back into Laura really quickly and say, you know, back at the motel, Laura, not knowing why her puppy has gone away, her sunshine has gone away. She puts her old clothes back on, not her cute dress, but her old, like, raggedy dead girl clothes. Mad Sweeney busts in. We find out the coin, you know, this is the question you and I had last week, like, where has she put the coin? She has no pockets at one point or whatever. And it's like, it's inside of her.
Just in there.
It's in the meat. She beats him up. She calls him Ginger Minge, which is a nice nickname, I believe, that was used on Ygritte in Game of Thrones. If you don't know,
an old one.
If you don't know what Minge is, Google it. I'm not going to.
another good example of Laura's casual vulgarity.
Yeah. Oddly European vulgarity.
You're a natural ginger.
Yeah, and then she. Mad Sweeney says of her coin, that's a coin you give to the King of America himself. And I feel like we got an email or a tweet where someone referred to Odin as, like, the King of America, or if anyone were to be the King of Gods in America, something like that, that it would be Odin. So that King of America phrase just made me think of Odin. Mm-hmm. Mad Sweeney calls Odin Grimnir, which is one of his alter egos. And he calls him a god. Says not to trust him. Mad Sweeney also reveals that Laura's, Jaqel and Ibis have stitched Laura up, that's not going to last very long.
Yeah.
Meat's going to slide off you sooner or later. Dead wife.
Dead wife.
I love that he calls her dead wife.
Yeah.
and he tries to drown her and is interrupted by the cops as Laura plays dead, which is pretty hilarious. Yeah. So I'm really loving this Mad Sweeney Laura dynamic. Oh, what did you think of it?
I loved it. I loved it a lot. The Laura character as portrayed in the television show has never been much of a shrinking violet. She's been sort of, like, defeated looking, but not by any particular individual. It's like she's got fight in her, but almost in a wounded animal, leave me alone kind of way. But when she's talking to Mad Sweeney, it's become really apparent Laura ain't taking shit from anybody. And now she has superpowers and she knows it. I love that she flicks his chin. She's not even surprised by what she can do at this point. And she's got the reflexes of Spider-Man. She's amazing. She can see his hand twitch before he even tries to hit her and just smacks it back. But Laura is Laura is very much in charge in this scene, and I really enjoy it. She's almost mean to him, though. There's nothing apologetic about. She knows this coin. She makes it very clear that this coin is what is keeping her walking around.
Right.
But she's not like, I'm sorry, but I need to have it, and you can't have it back. She's just like, no, fuck you. Fuck your feelings. This is mine. She also, and then she like squats down next to him and rubs it in his face. She's like, you're never, ever, ever getting it back. Not ever. Never. You're never getting it back. And I also enjoyed, actually, in that same like little speech that she gives him, she says, you can't take it from me, can you? I have to give it to you freely, which is interesting to me because it means that like Laura, maybe with her, you know, Anubis experience, has grasped or at least accepted the rules of this supernatural game a lot faster than Shadow has. Shadow's constant surprise in this episode was really interesting to me.
And like what I would have thought he's by surprised now. By, like,
yeah,
what he's surprised by is erratic to me. Like, it's just like, it doesn't, yes. Like, I'm like, oh, you're, that freaks you out, but this did but not. This did, like, yeah. Yeah.
But Laura is just sort of like, oh, okay, well, I'm like, Laura's just like, well, I'm dead. So nothing makes sense anymore at all. And she seems to catch on to the rules pretty quickly. So she's not at all. She doesn't even feel the need to mention to Shadow that he glows like the little sun of her life. And she's got Laura vision now. She doesn't seem to make,
Laura,
I mean, she,
vision.
She doesn't make very much of the fact that she's covered in stitches. She seems to think that Shadow's going to think that's fine. and then, yeah, she figures out real fast that Mad Sweeney can't take the coin and he's got to get her to give it back to him. So, he goes through sort of like the five stages of grief for his coin where he's like bargaining. And angry and like he's sad.
Oh, that's so true.
And she's just like, nope, 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 nope. I got this figured out. You would have taken it if you could have. And he can't.
You sure can't.
And then her little smile when she's like, that's right, I'm dead. I can play dead in a hot tub for as long as I want.
Oh, my God. But I loved how he pointed out, he's like, stop soaking your dead body. Because I thought of that, too. When she got in the bath, I'm like,
I did
that's
too.
Not what you should do with your dead body.
Come on, love. No. Come on. Didn't you seem Death Becomes Her?
All right, so we hop back to Wednesday and Shadow's sort of prison adventure. A spider opens Wednesday's cuff. He's like, I know that spider. It's not Anansi. Like, it doesn't look like Anansi to me as far as spiders go. It's quite green, and Anansi was sort of purple and blue. Is this like an Anansi friend? Like, does Odin have access to the entire spider network? Like, what's happening? We don't know, but that's okay. And then we get media floating in the room. See, this is the thing. It's like media floats in the room as Marilyn Monroe.
Shadow can't get over it for the rest of the
season. Out. And it's so silly when I'm like, your dead wife is back.
Also, you saw Lucy talk to you personally through a television screen. Like, what have you convinced yourself of in the meantime that it is now surprising to see the same person dressed as Marilyn Monroe floating.
Floating. Yeah, exactly.
Why is that more surprising than the television addressing you
exactly
as Lucille Ball?
Or all the other things that you've seen.
Oh, excuse me, Lucy Ricardo. Anyway.
Then we get the introduction of Mr. World, played by Crispin Glover, which I think is great casting.
Great casting.
You know, whatever I think of the scene, I think that is great casting. He says, you know, he apologizes. He's very solicitous to Odin. He says, I didn't see you, not clearly. You're huge. He calls Shadow out. He says, you have a blood type and recurring nightmare. And does an impression of Shadow's masturbation face. Mr. World makes the technical boy apologize. The technical boy, like, lays it on very thick, talking about, you know, they talked about already in this episode the idea of lynching a black man. Technical boy says, I didn't want to add to that climate of hatred. The new gods propose a merger. I really liked this line where Mr. World says spicy, medium, or chunky. They're all buying, it's all salsa or something like that. Like what everyone's buying. Odin doesn't like the idea of a merger. He says, you say merger, I say exile. And then Odin tries to sort of delineate the difference between the new gods and the old gods, where he says the new gods just occupy their time, there being the mortals, the worshippers, whereas the old gods gave something back. And, you know, the merger rejected. Mr. World is going to leave with the technical boy and media, and technical boy rightly points out to Mr. World, you keep letting him go. We have him here. Why are you letting him go? You know, and that's all glossing a bit over this like insane pitch that media gives as Marilyn, and that involves unicorns and flags and all sorts of stuff. And also this sort of, there's a lot of talk in this scene of rebranding, but what I feel like is they really have in this adaptation rebranded Mr. World as less of a surveillance god and more as a god of corporations, which I think is a good sort of reimagining of Mr. World. But what did you
In our current our current political climate, I'll venture to say that
corporate culture,
corporations are God and they can get away. Corporations now have their own access to and powers of surveillance, and they have their own media. They have their own, you know, patented technology that they are the pioneers of and the users of and the deployers of. And so, yeah, I agree with you. I think that's how Mr. World is, because the world has become more corporate, whether that's something that you're pleased about or not, that's I think a reality.
Yeah. And, I think Crispin Glover does a great job with his monologue
here. He always does a great job being creepy.
Yeah. I mean, you want creep. There's really no one better than Crispin Glover. But I don't know, this whole scene, there's something, it might have been that jazz music again, but there's just like, there's a lot going on in the scene. As far as introductions for Mr. World go, like the light up tile, the like sort of light up tiles underneath his feet, the very dapper appearance, the ingratiating demeanor, all of it really worked for me. The media as Marilyn stuff I actually almost found distracting. Like it was too much going on. Like I would have much preferred to just focus on all the things that Crispin Glover was throwing down as Mr. World and not had like Gillian Anderson like semi-orgasming in the corner all the time, you know, like
it was... I will say for like my own like personal just enjoyment, totally irrespective of the story, I would like to see Gillian Anderson impersonate at least two people per episode because I find it so entertaining. That being said, in terms of like how well the scene worked, she was definitely casting a big dark shadow on Crispin Glover's ability to deliver as Mr. World. And the unicorn animations were not helping that situation.
No. I mean, you would think like, you know, cause she gets,
I didn't understand the unicorns either. I was like, I liked the Odin missiles. I thought that was, good job. Well done. Great reference. We could probably pull a whole bunch more in. Why unicorns though? Like we don't need the unicorns. No Lisa Frank. We can lose that. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me because media got her own like show-stopping introduction in, you know, on the TV screens, and the technical boy got his like solo introduction. So why would the room be so crowded around Mr. World's introduction? Unless, you know, sort of distraction is the name of the game, which, you know, it might be, but yeah. You know, I love Crispin Glover. I think it is really good casting, and I just wanted a little bit more focus on him in that scene. So,
yeah, no, I agree. It was distracting, and I can only hope that it's because they are trying to make Mr. World appear less threatening or powerful than he actually is. Like he remains a bit of a mystery right now. We know what media is. She has a name that describes her function. We know what the technical boy is because he's obvious. Mr. World is still, we're not really clear in the context of the show what exactly his superpower is.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, you know, even as we struggle to define Mr. World, I think that's a good point that, that his presentation be a bit scattershot. But we do get like a heavy corporate vibe off of him, more so than you even get in the books. So that's kind of fun and I think a really good update. They leave. Shadow Wednesday, breakout. Everyone is dead. R.I.P. All those cops.
They are dead like, oh my God, what's the movie that I'm thinking of? Oh shit. You're going to have to cut this.
Or I could just like leave it on here. No, of you squirming.
Please don't. What are you It's the Sam Neill movie. Event Horizon. Yeah, they're all dead, Event Horizon style.
Their outsides are, or their insides are on their outsides.
They're all things.
Yeah. And then I've watched this scene twice, and I really could not fully tell you what happens next. Gail, do you care to describe what happens next?
All right. So, Lady Cop, we're sad to see that diligent Lady Cop, who is so interested in the truth, is dead in a chair. And the back of her chair, it is a wooden chair, the camera makes much of several times until it finally zooms in real close on a knot in the back of the chair, which opens up into an eyeball, which is also a knot. And then in a series of sort of confusing camera shots, branches like suddenly like stab Shadow in the side, and then, you know, branches and vines and roots are like bursting out of Lady Cop's cubicle and bursting through her mouth and chasing Shadow down the hall and somewhat impaling him. And that's it. That's all you get to see.
No idea what any of that means.
What that technically vine creature is. And like, I also watched this scene a number of times to try and get a clue, because my thoughts were, okay, you know, the last thing that we heard from media and from Mr. Wednesday was, we're going to tell whatever story we want the new gods to get away with this. And, you can tell whatever story you want, but, ours is going to win. And this whole mess is not going to follow either one of us around, probably, unless we want it to. And so they go running out of this place, the new gods disappear, and then Mr. Wednesday and Shadow are left to try and escape. So I have to assume that it seemed logical that this like plant creature would be something that the new gods are using to disguise a really super weird murder scene, but it seems very organic. For the new gods. And then if it's something to do with the old gods, why is it trying to impale Shadow?
What even is it?
What god could it possibly be? And I was like looking for clues everywhere. And I you know, sort of like thinking about the book and the various gods, and I was like, I have no idea. They're currently in Ohio. Because Bellefontaine is in Ohio. So I'm just trying to like figure out from the context of the book and what is going on in the scene, which is wholly invented. This did not happen in the book. Right. What this could possibly be. And I have no idea. I cannot help you.
Is it a Buckeye?
I was like, is it an Ent?
If it's a Buckeye, that's the, anyway, if you listener feel like you know what is going on with that chair and everything associated with that chair, please do email SisStormOfSpoilers@gmail.com or shoot us a tweet. Then we come to our last sort of pair of scenes, which is Mad Sweeney breaking out of the cop car, where he was sort of handcuffed, and Laura breaking out of the morgue because she's not actually dead, and taking her effects, sadly studying herself in the mirror, realizing she has no breath, and getting out of there. I really don't, I mean, I really hate, from a storytelling perspective, when something happens and then there's no real reason for it. So why was Mad Sweeney arrested if he's just then going to escape? And why is Laura, you know, like, why did any of that happen?
Yeah.
If they're both just going to then immediately escape, how does it help the episode, for them to be you know, if you could have just left them sort of at a standoff in that hotel room. So why did any of that happen? And I'm happy to leave it until the next episode to find out, but I really better get some narrative satisfaction, because that seems to me a little bit of a chasing its tail, scenario.
I couldn't even figure out how the cops found out there was a disturbance. I mean, did the neighbor call them? Like, why did the cops break down the door? Did you understand that?
Whoever tipped off, I mean, who knows?
I guess.
What those ravens are up to, who knows who's tipping off whom. Like, the cops being
ravens can't talk. not well, but I mean, it's conceivable one of them picked up the phone.
But the cost being tipped off bothers me less than just sort of like,
from a storytelling perspective.
If someone's scooped up and then immediately escapes, why are you scooped up to begin with? So we'll see if next week answers my question. Is there anything else we want to say about this episode, which I have to admit was not a favorite episode of mine, and I feel like is a bit of a come down after how much I liked last week? What did you think?
I agree. I think this one, to be honest with you, even more than the first episode, I think this one was very scattered.
Yeah.
And I'm really hoping that it was simply because they did not have time in the space of 1 hour to resolve the questions that, that would have been better explained in a longer episode. So I am holding out hope that next week we're going to get some better answers, and some better storytelling for, you know, whatever direction they have decided to take the characters in. And there were a number, I don't know. Can I ask you, what you thought in the morgue? For one thing, the breakout of the morgue, I think would have been a lot better served if there had not been an attendant, because he was looking at pictures of miniature horses online.
I missed that entirely.
Yeah. I went back twice to make sure, because I was like, he's looking at porn or some weird thing. That's what morgue guys always do. No, it's just ponies.
It's
just
true. Ponies. When you were like, he was looking at, I was like, oh my God, was he looking at dead people? Yeah, and no.
Nope. And he, like, you know, he was listening to something pretty innocuous. Like, it was like coit, you know. 96.5 soft rock.
That's some
local. And he was looking at pictures of miniature horses.
KYT light rock, less talk. That's for the Bay Area listeners.
Yeah, and he's looking at pictures, and they're like, I looked, guys. I can promise you, nothing weird was going on in those pictures of ponies and miniature horses. They were like just, like he was an enthusiast, and then he gets. I mean, with the force that door was kicked off, I think he died.
I choose to believe he's not dead.
Like to believe he's not dead. I just feel like, you know, probably you sustain at least grievous injury from having a metal morgue door kicked off onto you at that velocity. And I just don't think that was fair or necessary. I think Laura has enough problems as a character, you know, with her own like ethics and morality, without killing innocent pony enthusiast morgue attendants. Why was that guy there?
I'm not dead
yet. Did you
really
have an alarm system? Like,
feeling much better.
Security prison. Why is this guy even working the night shift? I don't know anything about morgues.
Why did she even get into the morgue? I mean, like, what is the point of any of that?
Wake up at some point in the ambulance and just open the doors and fall out into the street. I don't know.
Let's tune in next week to find out. I don't know, but I agree with you. if that morgue guy died, that poor pony enthusiast died for no reason. I will be bereft. Okay, so that sort of wraps up our non-spoilery discussion of season one, episode five. Gail and I are going to hop into a spoiler section real quickly to talk a little bit more about the introduction of a new character in this episode. And so you'll want to be careful before you wade into that. But if you don't join us for that, we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Ta.
So welcome to the extra spoiler section of Storm of Spoilers, Exploration of American Gods. This is where I want to talk at least a little bit more about Mr. World, because this is like the one thing that I feel the need to be quite precious about. I might have sort of kvetched about this on an earlier episode, but I've seen some people online. There's like a Guide to the Gods of American Gods article on Vulture now. Where they just like straight up say that like Loki, Lysmith is Loki. I haven't checked yet whether or not they say that Mr. World is Loki, but like that Loki reveal is like the one, like Odin is Odin. I want to talk about that from the beginning, but Loki, like that's giving the whole game away. So, and theoretically, that's a game that won't even like get a resolution till season two. So, why do it anyway? But you know, I know, and if you're in the spoiler section now, you know that Mr. World and Loki Lysmith is in fact Loki. And he's working in codes, Mr. Wednesday.
That's why he keeps letting him go.
That's why Technical Boy's like, why do you let him go? I was like, that's a great, I thought that was a great addition. Like, why do you keep letting him go? I'm like, yeah, buddy.
And it was just, oh my gosh. I did like that part of the scene as someone in the know, because like Technical Boy was, and Mr. World has some comment. He says something about like, I'm leaving on a good line. Like, shut it. You're ruining it.
Yeah.
But Technical Boy won't let it go and has to have the teeth knocked out of him. Anyway, yeah, it went on for quite some time. Like, Technical Boy made much of that.
Yeah. So that's why I you know, okay, so if it's Loki, if it's Mr. World who tipped off the cops, and the cops intercepted Shadow and Wednesday outside of the motel room, you know, that makes me feel like this is Mr. Wednesday's gambit to get Shadow away from Laura, is like, have us get arrested, so to separate you, to pry you away from Laura, and maybe send the cops in. Maybe that's what the second round of cops was for, to like, you know, not necessarily knowing Mad Sweeney was there, but like to find Laura and do something with her. I don't know.
But,
and so then obviously this whole introduction is engineered. This is all part of Mr. Wednesday's long con with Loki as his partner in grift to, you know, convince Shadow of certain things. You know, as far as it goes in the books, Media and Technical Boy are not in on this because Mr. World slash Loki is working against their interests. His interests in the end is in advantage Old God. And so he sort of like embedded himself as the boss of the new gods, in order to help bring them down. And, you know, and so, you know, that's sort of what I was alluding to. I'm sure you picked up earlier when I said maybe it's better that room is crowded, that scene is crowded, so that Shadow and everyone is distracted. I mean, that's what con men do, right?
Yes. Is
they create a bunch of distractions so that you don't see that they've like changed the $10 bill for the $5 bill or whatever it is.
Yeah. And that's a whole, like, that's a theme within the book as well regarding Shadow's coin tricks, is it's constantly brought up, the distraction. Like, what do you look at? Divert the audience's attention.
Right. So if everyone's looking at Media, like, doing her best Marilyn in the corner, maybe you miss sort of the nuance of what's going on between Mr. World, the performance of what's going on between Wednesday and Mr. World, for the benefit of Media, of Technical Boy and Shadow and us. So
I had to go back and look at that scene again, also to look at Mr. Wednesday's face while Mr. World is giving Technical Boy the speech about this man deserves her respect. And Ian McShane just like pursing his lips and nodding sagely and like sort of just.
But also, like, you know, the the whole deal that Mr. World's offering and Mr. Wednesday rejecting it. I mean, it's all performance. And
great speech about being the irritating piece of sand.
Yeah, in the oyster.
Basically a gilding the turd kind of speech. Yeah.
Yeah, so that, you know, that's just a little extra something that I wanted to talk about in the spoiler section is our knowledge that this is a grift that we're watching in progress, and only Wednesday World and the book readers know what they're watching. And
yeah. There's an elaborate grift. I am sorry, I can't remember. I don't think it is described explicitly by Mr. Wednesday in the show, but he does describe it in detail in the book. And the violin one where he's describing to Shadow, you know, his favorite cons. And this is shortly after the bank robbery. And it's, you're a little bit distracted by the fact in the writing, the fact that, Mr. Wednesday is in the process of like weirdly seducing this like skinny 16-year-old girl who has like been roped into working at this diner on Christmas Eve. So you are like paying attention to two things even within the book, but he's describing this con where, I mean, not to go into too much detail, but basically it is a two-man con, as Mr. Wednesday says, like all good cons. This is something that's an interesting point as well, because that was brought up in the show. You know, you need two people to pull off these really good cons. Well, Shadow thinks he's man number two.
No.
And it's so sad.
I mean, like, and that really does inform the, like, the bank. If you go back to the bank heist scene, like, that's working on, like, nine levels of, like, Odin making him think that he's his second man.
Shadow
really, like, liking it.
And then in the cop scene, you know, the lady cop walks him in, and she's put on a really good show and presented some really compelling reasons why he should sell Mr. Wednesday out. She walks him into the room with Odin and says he's loyal. He hasn't said a word. It worked. Mr. Wednesday got Shadow on his side. Shadow thinks he's Mr. Wednesday's wingman. And he so isn't.
Yeah,
but yeah, like all great cons.
You are the patsy, in fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like all great cons, Mr. Wednesday's favorite con requires two people. And I think the way that it works is you get the poor guy down on his luck with the violin. Hey, can you basically hold this in trust for me? It's worth, it's worth $75 or something. And you give him $75. He goes off. He goes to his nephew's funeral, or he gets a shave in a bath, or whatever he does. He's going to come back with $75 and get his violin back. And then a second guy comes in and says, oh my, you know, he's been sitting in the restaurant this whole time. And he says, oh my God, do you know what that's worth? That violin is worth, you know, $75,000. You gotta tell this guy, you know, if he ever wants to sell it, will you please, you know, give him my card here. And then the guy comes back and here's the $75. Pay you back for, you know, the dinner or the shave or whatever it is. Can I have my violin back? Well, I'd really like to buy the violin for you. Talk him up to, I don't know, $10,000. You still know you're going to get $75,000. No, he doesn't want to let it go. It's his whole livelihood. Oh, okay, fine. And with tears in his eyes, he accepts $10,000 for his worthless old violin that's just been his friend for all these years. He has nothing but sentimental attachment to it. But it's worth $5 in reality. Right. And these two guys pulled off this con. So it's a, you know, it's a great con. And in the context of this story, you got to think, like, which of them, you know, which one is Loki and which one is Odin, in your opinion?
That Odin is the humble, like the down on the luck guy. And then Loki is the guy who comes in and sort of like
he's the knowledgeable one.
Bumps it up. Yeah, and says like, "Do you know the value of this?" I mean, he did it. He did it in that scene where he's like, "This man is, you know, deserves your respect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera."
And it was weird in that scene. Like, I felt like that was. It was weird. I think you're right. That was. It was just like, even for Loki, it was not artfully done. Suspicious, but Shadow was just so busy looking at Marilyn's feet. You didn't notice, I guess.
That con job that you described, the violent con job, there, they do a version of it in the film Zombieland with fake diamond rings. And then it's also, there's a version of it in last two seasons, I don't know, whatever. One of the seasons of Better Call Saul. So that's like where I think it's like a coin. So that's like, it's, you know, it's whatever it is, it's like... can you just hold on to this for me? I'll be right back. And then you need man number two to be like, that thing's worth so much. And then come back. And the hope is that that person offers you money for that thing. So,
it plays on people's greed.
Yep.
And as it's pointed out in the book, it doesn't work if the person is honest, but you don't lose anything either. You don't lose anything by somebody else's honesty.
Yeah, so it's not, I mean, it's not quite a one-for-one because I don't think that Shadow is the – Shadow would just give the violin back, right, and say,
like, he would.
Hey, buddy, do you know what this is worth? You know, so, you know.
He'd be tempted, but only if Laura was there to tempt him. So I don't know. Maybe that's why Laura needs to be out of the way, frankly.
But yeah, this is a two-man con job, which is like just a fun reveal of American Gods and one that I hope you know, people who know what it is keep it under their hats, but
it's no fun.
I don't know. It's just
no fun if you give the game away.
I just want to see, hold on 1 second. If this vulture okay, no, they keep the Mr. World thing under their hat. So, but they blew the Loki thing. The Loki Christmas
thing.
That
is unforgivable, though.
That's not great.
So, yeah, that's bad. Yeah. You can't do that.
Anyway, those are my weird spoiler boundaries that I have erected around American Gods.
Very particular spoiler boundaries.
So we will be back next week talking about episode 7. Episode 6. Episode 6 is next week, and there's only 8 episodes in the season, so we are getting close to the end of the series. But, Gail, where can people find you until then?
You can find me on Twitter at @ClockworkRose.
And you can find me at Joe Wrote This. You can find me on the regular Storm of Spoilers feed. You can find me on Little Gold Men. You can find me on the Twin Peaks podcast, Peaks TV. You can find me... I remember what I started with, so that's good enough for now. until next week, only the gods are real.